Good morning, everyone, from Bogota, Colombia. I'm Stephen Downs. It's April 18th, 2007. I'm here in Colombia to give a talk on e-learning, and we're just about to get going, so I'll put this down on the stage, and we'll wait for the introductions.
Buenos días. Damos inicio al primer Congreso Internacional de E-Learning Sin Límites. Saludo y bienvenida a cargo de Jennifer Reyes, directora de Mercadeo de Latinet Colombia, organizadora de este evento.
Buenos días a todos ustedes, señoras y señores. Sean bienvenidos al primer Congreso Internacional de E-Learning Sin Límites. Agradecemos a todos ustedes su presencia, que nos estimula y anima. Se encuentran en este recinto muchos de nuestros aliados, clientes y amigos. Nos acompañan autoridades y funcionarios de las instituciones del sector académico, a la vez que representantes de diversas empresas. Como bien saben, este congreso contará con expositores de talla internacional y nacional. Canadá es nuestro país invitado, debido a su trayectoria como pionero y por ser uno de los más avanzados en el uso de implementación de e-learning. También nos acompañan representantes de Estados Unidos, Chile, Argentina y, por supuesto, Colombia. Los tres ejes temáticos a tratar en estos dos días en Sin Límites serán tendencias de e-learning, simulaciones aplicadas al aprendizaje virtual y mejores prácticas de diseño instruccional, temas claves para la comprensión de los beneficios y ventajas de la implementación de e-learning en las organizaciones. Al organizar este primer Congreso Sin Límites, Latinet planteó convertirse en un referente de la industria de e-learning, mediante un espacio anual de interacción y transferencia de conocimiento. Buscamos difundir el e-learning para que sea adoptado por todo el mundo, que sirva para el desarrollo de las comunidades y el cierre de la brecha digital, que los jóvenes tengan un potente herramienta que les haga más competentes y mejores ciudadanos, y que las empresas y organizaciones puedan utilizar la capacitación de su gente. Los invitamos desde ya a recibir, con mente abierta al conocimiento, las experiencias de todos los expertos que han querido compartir sus éxitos y sinsabores, para el beneficio de cada uno de los proyectos en los que están ustedes involucrados. Reiteramos nuestra gratitud por acompañarnos y esperamos que juntos rompamos paradigmas. Gracias.
Bien. El doctor Dawes, se desempeña desde el 2001 como investigador del grupo de e-learning del Instituto para la Tecnología de Información del Consejo Nacional de Investigación de Brunswick, Canadá. Sobre el mismo tema, ha trabajado en las universidades de Alberta, el Assiniboine Community College y la Universidad de Athabasca. Como investigador, ha publicado múltiples artículos y participado como conferencista en congresos en los cinco continentes. El señor Downs es MEA DEI de la Universidad de Calgary, en Canadá. Los dejo con uno de los más reconocidos investigadores del e-learning de nuestro país invitado, Canadá, el doctor Stephen Downs y su conferencia El futuro del aprendizaje en línea y las redes de conocimiento.
Gracias. Buenos días. It's a great pleasure to be able to return here to Bogota. I was here last July and had a very, very warm welcome, so it's a great pleasure to be able to come back. I'm pleased to be able to talk to you today about online learning, and in particular, in the second part of my presentation, about personal learning environments. Online learning has been around for more than 10 years now. And it began very simply. It began with simple web pages and email, mailing lists, and things like that. And in the last 10 years, it has grown tremendously both in scope and in the number of people who are engaged in it. There are many positive developments, especially in the last couple of years, that I would like to talk about. Probably one of the major trends that is impacting online learning today is the use of open source applications. Open source applications are typically obtained for free and are used for free. As well, open source is important for online learning because the data, the content, is more easily transferred from one application to another. Because we are able to see the source, the actual computing code of the program, we are able to see how the data is created, how the data is encoded. Programs like Moodle and Sakai and Written Boddington and A-Tutor are all learning management systems that have, over the last 2 or 3 years, gained an increasing market share in learning. People who are developing commercial learning management systems are very worried today, I think, about open source applications. But their deployment is nothing but good for the educational institutions that use them. But it's not just learning management systems. There's a wide range of open source tools that are available today. Community management tools like Drupal, tools for the creation of learning resources like LANX, which helps you create learning activities, ELTG, which is a social networking application to create learning communities, and WordPress, which is an application students can use to put their own writing online. And then, of course, there is the software that has become used by many people around the world, the open source browser, Firefox. If you are not using Firefox now, you should be using Firefox. Also, open source email, Thunderbird. Open Office for the creation of PowerPoint slides or Microsoft Word documents, and even a program called Audacity. Audacity is a sound recording and editing tool. I use Audacity myself when I record talks like this. You can see my little iRiver there sitting there on the stage. It's very small, and I've partly broken. But it's on right now. I'm recording this talk, and I would use Audacity to prepare this talk and to be able to put it up on the internet. Another major trend, and an increasingly important trend in online learning, is the development of open educational resources. You may already be familiar with a very notable project, MIT's OpenCourseWare initiative. What MIT has done has made all the learning resources for all of their courses, this is hundreds and hundreds of courses, available online for anybody in the world to use, to reuse, to employ for any purpose in the development of their own learning or teaching resources if they're teaching at times. MIT's open courseware has spread beyond MIT, and there is now a consortium of about 12 or so
universities
called the Open Courseware Consortium. And again, they are doing the same thing. Britain's Open University is also releasing its courses, which are all in course packages, ready to use to learn online for free. And that's just one of the many open content initiatives coming out of Britain. It's not on the slide, but the British Broadcasting Corporation, again, is making many of its resources available. There are international initiatives in open educational resources. UNESCO and OECD have initiated projects for open educational resources, and these are beginning to get get off the ground. UNESCO recently, about a week or two ago, launched an open educational resources platform, a place where people will go access those open educational resources. And then I would be remiss if I did not mention Creative Commons, which is a way for any person to attach a license to their own content to make it open and freely available to everyone in the world. When I was here in Bogota last July, I had the pleasure of meeting the representatives from Creative Commons Colombia. There are people in Colombia who are involved in this project and who are making materials from Colombia available for everybody else around the world. In online learning, we are also seeing many new environments being developed. There's an explosion of multimedia. We're seeing podcasts, which is the use of audio sound on the internet. My recording will be a podcast. Podcasts. That's like a video podcast where people record videos of themselves. I see there's a video recorder at the back of the room there, and it'll be on the camera, so if I move, I'll go off the screen. Let me do that. I just like messing with the people who are watching video later. Hi, people on video. It's funny because the new technology, it changes, doesn't it? It changes your teaching. I have to be aware when I'm talking here that I'm not just talking to you, but I'm talking to the people who are listening on the audio and the people who are watching on the video. It creates a different sort of environment. We're hearing a lot about mobile computing these days. Computing using mobile phones or personal digital secret data. I forget what PDA stands for. I've been calling it PDA for so many years, etc. And in the last year or so, there has been a lot of hype about the 3D web. Second Life is one particular application. I personally think, because Second Life is closed and it's proprietary, it's not an open source application, and it's owned all by one company, that Second Life itself is not necessarily the future. But applications like Second Life that people can use to see a 3D world online will become increasingly important. Not next year, but in 5 years or 10 years. Finally, I also want to talk about access, because my own personal reason for being involved in this field is that I've always believed that online learning increases access to learning for everybody, access to learning for people who cannot afford it. You look at the cost of tuition for colleges and universities, and it's increasingly apparent that we need to be able to put low-cost and efficient ways of obtaining an education that make those available for people. The one-to-one computing project that began in Maine in the United States a few years ago, where each student in the grade 7 class is given their own computer, has shown the power of putting computers into students' hands. Just last week, the One Laptop Per Child project launched in Nigeria. It was called the $100 computer project. It actually came in at about $140 US. And in Nigeria and in other countries, they're buying 1 million of these and putting them into the hands of children. And this follows the philosophy of people like Seymour Papert, who say that the children, once they get access, once they get the tools in their hands, will be able to take charge of a large part of their own learning. And so the computers in the One Laptop Per Child project are not simply about presenting educational materials to children. They're about giving children the capacity to communicate, to form a community, and to work with the educational materials and to be creative. And that underscores many of the trends in e-learning today.
e-learning today is changing the way the internet is changing. We hear an awful lot today about Web 2.0. Web 2.0 is like open source. It's like social networks. It's like communities of people online talking to each other, communicating with each other. It's like blogs and blogging, where people create their online journals or their thoughts. I have my own website where I put my own materials online. The reason why I'm here today is not because I've written famous journal articles or a book. In fact, I have not written a book. I might one day, but not yet. But it's because of my blog and the work that I present every day online for people to see and become part of an online learning community. It's like wikis and collaborative writing, where people can come together and create their own learning resources without needing publishers and authorities and experts to do it for them. And it's like new ways of recognizing what kind of materials are important and what kind of materials are not. Like tagging. This is a way where individuals classify materials by themselves. And each person who looks at a resource classifies this material, associates a word with that material. You know, we hear a lot that, or more, it seems like we hear a lot from vendors of e-learning and proponents of e-learning that, you know, there's a magic solution. We put the software into their hands and they will all magically learn. And I think that what's becoming clearer over the time that we have learned about learning online is that there is no magic solution. There is no magic shortcut. Teaching is online, as it always was, modeling and demonstration. To be a teacher is not simply to tell students what to believe and what to do, but to be what you want your students to be, to show in your own actions, in your own behaviors, whether it's your conduct or the way you do your research or the way you work with your community. And to learn, we know, is to practice and to reflect. You can't just plug it into your head. There's no machine that you can pour content into someone's mind. A learner has to be engaged. They have to model what they see, they have to try to do it themselves, and then they have to think about that practice. Think about what worked and what didn't work, where they were successful, where they weren't successful. And it's this sort of approach that is informing the development of new learning environments and new learning tools on the internet. For example, game-based learning. We hear a lot about that from people like Bart Aldrich, James Paul G. And the object of game-based learning is not simply to give the student something fun to do. Rather, the object of game-based learning is to put them into an environment, into a simulation, to immerse them in the material that they are learning so that they are making choices, doing activities, making decisions, where there are consequences to what they do. Make one wrong turn in a game and something will beat you. This is a powerful learning incentive. This also applies to the world of the workplace, where instead of learning doing something separate, that you go away and you do in a separate room, learning is more and more becoming part of what you do. It becomes part of the workflow. The idea here is that the application that you use and the learning that you need for that application or for what you're doing with that application come together. They're in the same place. When you create a document using Microsoft Word, the help you need in the future will be right in that document. Online learning now is at a crossroads. It's at a point of change. In the past, we have developed tools and systems intended to present learning. But what has happened in the last 2 years or so is that we are looking at new tools and new technologies that will support immersive learning, putting the student in the learning. The first iteration, the first instance of this, has already passed. We have seen the widespread use of blogs and blogging in learning environments. On the one hand, it is true that many schools are blocking blogs and blogging applications. But on the other hand, many other schools are not. And in those schools, these tools are being used, and we are seeing with a lot of evidence that it's supporting learning. Students are podcasting, creating their own podcast. Bob Sprankle's class, I forget what grade it is, I think it's grade 6 or something like that. They produce their own podcast, their own grade 6 news that they release to everyone on the internet. And students are not simply playing games, they're taking control of games. They're creating what are called mods. A mod is a modification of a game. It's some software that you create that you integrate with the game to create a new game. And so students are now able to build their own games. One of my favorite games, Civilization. That's a game where you start out with a hunter and then you control the world. You see why I like that one. That game has a basic Civ engine, and then you can change anything. You can change the types of people, you can change the behaviors, you can change the world. You can create a world made completely out of snowflakes if you want. Don't know why you want, but you could. This is evolving into Web 2.0, or as I call it, the learning network. And we are seeing more and more ways of integrating this for the presentation of student material in something called the e-portfolio. If you look at the e-portfolio, there are now some e-portfolio software solutions available. You can see that students are using them to present their creative materials. In some cases, for evaluation, and in other cases, just so that they're able to present themselves, their identity online for others to see. This will be very powerful in a few years when these same students go to apply for jobs and they are asked, like, what are your credentials? And the students won't simply point to a degree or a diploma. They will say, here are my credentials. Here is what I have made. Here is what I have created. This has long been the case in computing science, where when you went to apply for a job with Microsoft or Google or whatever, you showed them the software that you developed. What is happening, what is beginning to take form, is the creation of methods to distribute and, as we say, syndicate this content. Methods that allow a person to create content here and have that content seen all in different places all around the internet. The mechanism for this is increasingly a type of XML called RSS. RSS, as I say, is an XML language. It is a very simple XML language. One of the major things that we have learned is that designing programs, programming for the web, simple works best. And the reason why simple works best is because people can take something that is simple and then add their own thing to it. And in a lot of cases, this is what has happened with RSS. So all of the applications that I talked about, the open content applications, Google, the learning management system applications, blog software, Drupal, all of these applications already support RSS. which means if you use one of these applications to create content, you are automatically creating RSS. You don't even need to think about it. The tool is doing this for you. And this is important because by that fact, the creation of your content makes your content available to all of these other tools, to other people all around the internet. And you can begin to see, can't you, that there could be a network created connecting people to people as they read each other's content. This is where the idea of the personal learning environment comes from. I know that's a hard diagram to read. It's a very famous diagram. It was created originally by Scott Wilson for CETUS in Britain. And it's been modified by people around the internet. We've made it our own. Thank you, Scott. The idea is that the personal learning environment, now I'm going to move over to the field of the camera. The personal learning environment is at the center. I know it says future BLE here, but that was before we knew what we were calling it. And then around the personal learning environment are different applications spread all across the internet. LiveJournal, for example, and other blogging applications. LearnDirect, and other e-learning content applications. Personal hosting services, including your e-portfolio. Oh. Roger, you listening? Flickr and other services that allow you to... Actually, I have a pointer, don't I? I'm not used to having pointers. But it's so small you can't see it. Flickr and other applications where you can store your images. 43 things for to-do lists. And any of hundreds and hundreds of applications. And these are spread all over the internet. Now I don't want to put this down. All over the internet. And what happens is a student, a learner, gets a personal learning environment. She's the one who lost her luggage. I'm getting stuff from her. Technology is music. The student, now I want to play. I really should pay attention to what I'm doing. The student gets their own personal learning environment, and then they choose which of these applications they are going to use. They create their own learning environment out of all of the services that are on the internet. Now think about what this means for you as education providers. You can't necessarily expect students to go to your university learning management system or to your courseware or online application. What you have becomes one of many choices for students, which means your choices need to be appealing to students, but also from a technical perspective, the choices need to be set up in such a way that they can integrate with the future personal learning environment. And the way to integrate it is using things like RSS. What does the other button do? Flashlight. Any more toys? Come on. One of the early personal learning environments was created by the people at CETUS. They called it PLEX. You can tell it's an early, primitive version because it looks like a Microsoft application. I couldn't resist that. And it's sort of, it kind of looks like, you know, some sort of file management tool. I think that personal learning environments will be a lot easier to use. They'll be a lot more visual. My own work in this field began with a simple little application called MindGlue. And MindGlue has a very simple purpose. Never mind. It takes several RSS feeds from different applications, maybe one from Yahoo and one from Flickr and one from Blogger. It joins them all together and then it filters this according to some topic. For those of you who are computer programmers, I use regular expressions to filter the topics. And then that produces an output. That output can be in one of many forms, including, and I use it for this, a new RSS feed. So you can sort of see now how I'm creating this node in a network, right? I'm bringing things together, I process them, I send a new signal on. It's just a node in the network. Then I created something called RSS Writer. This is totally prototype. It doesn't work particularly well, but it works well enough to prove the concept. And in the RSS Writer, I choose my content source, for example, MindGlue, which I've just created. That'll give me a whole list of resources here. Then I drag and drop these resources into a content editor. And I edit the content, add new content, reformat it. I can bring content in from many different sources and then remix it. And then finally, when I'm done, and you can't see it because it's below the screen here, I can send it forward to Blogger or LiveJournal or Delicious or any of these other applications that are distributed all over the internet. Here's a slightly different version of the same thing, the EduRSS Viewer, where here I might be viewing some RSS content from some other application. My system has created tags for it. It has applied these content filters to it that I mentioned. And then by clicking on this button, I can blog it. I can send it forward to some other place on the internet. The idea here is that people will be able to work with many different kinds of content. In my system, I work not just with blog posts, but also with journals and links and feeds, events, people, publications, organizations, all kinds of different things, all kinds of different types of content. And the different types of content are limited only by your imagination. In all of this, the challenge now becomes, because we have this whole network of distributed content, how do we get the right resource to the right person at the right time? Imagine a scenario in your head. You are typing a paper, perhaps you are writing a paper for a presentation or to write in a journal, or maybe you are a student and it's your class essay. And as you type your paper, your word processor is suggesting references and resources to you. It's more likely to suggest resources that you've already read and already commented on. But it may sometimes suggest new things. And the question is, how does it know what to suggest? Where does it get to it? Well, it gets them from this network, but it needs to understand how to use the network in order to retrieve the right resource. The old way, and you've probably heard a lot about this, to choose the right resource has been to try to describe the resource as precisely as possible. Oops. This one launches the enterprise. This is learning object metadata. SCORM. Ways of describing learning resources. The problem with that sort of metadata is that it's limited. It's only a description of the resource, and it doesn't tell us about the relations the resource has with other resources. The new way draws on a technology called recommender systems. The recommender systems have a long history on the internet. I first saw recommender systems in 1998 in a program called Firefly. That was bought by Microsoft and then it disappeared. But companies like Amazon.com use recommender systems. A very popular application of recommender systems, believe it or not, is online dating services. And this is an online dating service. And the idea here is you associate several descriptions. The idea is that you find out properties of the one person, properties of the other person, properties of the things that they have in common. This is what Firefly did. Firefly looked at your musical tastes and it learned these musical tastes, you told it what they were, and then it matched you with people with similar musical tastes. But it doesn't, this kind of system doesn't just have to match people. Yahoo has a service called Launch that listens or follows what you play, and you can also rate songs as you listen to them. And it also knows about you, so now it knows what kind of person you are, what kind of music you like, and then the next person that comes along, it says, well, people who are kind of like you like this kind of music, and then it begins to propose new music for you to see. So you can see that the recommender system is already doing the task that I described when you're typing up your Word document, is presenting options for you to use. What makes this work is not simply the descriptions, but rather the relations between the different types of entities. We create a network joining resources and people and organizations and events and so on. When we see how all of these things are put together, that gives us a network, and the shape of that network is what presents the right resource to us. How does it work? Well, it's easiest to use a metaphor or an analogy here. It's like finding patterns in a mesh. It's like pattern recognition. Here are all these related things, all these related things in a network all together, and when you look at that network, you can see the pattern that comes out. It looks like what are called in computer science connectionist systems. And again, these are all the network, these are all the different resources, the different services, the people, the events that are all connected together. And the patterns in that network represent concepts. We can use the network to represent things like trees, like couches, like cute little puppy dogs. And the idea is that when we have this kind of pattern in the network, that tells us to bring up this kind of resource. And when we have this kind of pattern in the network, that tells us we want a puppy dog. It works the same way the human mind works. The human mind is a network of connected nodes called neurons. And when we think of something, like a tree, or a puppy dog, or a couch, what we are actually doing is activating a pattern of connections in our minds. It's like our neurons start firing and sending messages to each other. And when they send messages, they create this pattern. So I think a puppy dog, the pattern gets created, and then I say puppy dog or something else, depending on what I'm thinking. It is into this picture, into this model of the personal learning environment. This is the way the brain works, but it's also the way the emerging internet works. And in, so this is the internet. This is the Web 2.0 internet. And then in this network, we find the personal learning environment. That's a very important concept. The personal learning environment, this tool, is just one node in the network. And it works with other personal learning environments and other applications. You can sort of see the original picture. Here's the personal learning environment. Here's a blogging engine. Here's Flickr. Here's Yahoo. Here's the university site, all connected. Or these might be other people that they're connected. This is a very important concept. That the way the network learns how to present the right resource to you is the same as the way the mind learns how to get the right answer on a test. It's the organization of the network, the creation of patterns in the network. We know a lot about how these networks work in computer science. We know a lot about how these connections are formed and how these connections are joined. How we pick one pattern rather than another pattern. And that model leads to this learning theory. That model leads to the theory that says to teach is to model and to demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. When we are working with one of these networks in computer science, a connectionist network, we do not program that network, we train it. And the way we train that network is to give it input over and over. And sometimes we correct it, and in other cases, the network by itself settles into a pattern of connectivity. You can read about this. You can read about this in the work, if you look up connectionism on Google, read people like Rumelhart, McClellan, and for that matter, people like Marvin Minsky and, big surprise, Seymour Papert, who have done lots of work in the computer science of connectionist systems. That's the key insight. The one laptop per child project is based on this model. So what is the personal learning environment? We use the model to tell us what the tool looks like. To teach is to model and to demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. The learner or the student exercises choice, has an identity through this system that results from that choice, and uses this identity, expresses this identity in creativity, in creating projects like e-portfolios and blog posts or whatever. Now we can learn about the functionality of the personal learning environment by looking at each of these parts. When we look at model, for example, what do we mean when we say to model something? What is it to model being a physicist? Or being a computer scientist, or being a doctor, or being a policeman. Well, there are different ways that each of these professions model how they do what they are doing. They can use wikis, and a lot of professions are already beginning to use wikis to record vocabularies and concepts, things like that. You can use concept maps, which may be expressed in open mapping formats using open applications. Or Glippy, which is one of these Web 2.0 applications that lets you create neat little flowcharts. You can reference frameworks, something very general like Wikipedia, or something very specific like videos or 3D representations that I've been talking about. What is it to demonstrate? Well, we use examples, right? We use examples of computer code. I learned to program not from a teacher, but from code libraries. I learned how to program by looking at how other people created computer programs. How was I able to do that? Because they used open source. Because it was open source, I could see what they did, I could see the model that they demonstrated, and then emulate that model for myself. But it's not just computers, you can do the same thing for images. Learn how to be a good photographer by looking at the photographs that other people, professionals and amateurs alike, have created. Thought processes. How people think. I remember a column by a writer called Jerry Cornell. If you know Jerry Cornell, he's very famous in science fiction writing. I read a lot of his books. He used to have a column in Byte magazine called Chaos Manor. And what he would do, it was basically him playing with his computer. And he'd start his column, this week I'm going to try to install a networking application. And then he'd describe all the different things that he did, the things that worked and the things that didn't work. He'd do something, then he'd write it down. He'd do something, then he'd write it down. He'd document his thought process. And that became part of the way of working. It becomes part of the job, not just to do the job, but to document what you're doing. And then application, you'll see some case studies this afternoon even of how e-learning is being used in various companies in Canada. And stories, a whole school of thought, a whole community devoted to using the internet to teach using storytelling. What is it to practice? There's game interfaces, there's sandboxes, which are websites where you can go play with applications. There are sandboxes for the programs that I told you about, Drupal and WordPress and the like. There are very simple things, like job-based cheat sheets. One of the things that I use off the internet, again, I'm teaching myself to program, right? I'm not a very good programmer. I need a cheat sheet. I need some way to remember what the command is. So I just go on the internet and get a little cheat sheet and put it up on mobile. Eventually, I don't need the cheat sheet anymore. Games and simulations, other ways of practicing, these mod kits that I was telling you about, ways of shaping and reshaping and creating your own games. See how all the separate little things that are happening on the internet are all coming together now to form this sort of network of practice. And then finally, reflection, guided reflection, being able to record one's own thoughts, to record presentations and seminars, to record blog journal posts, things like that, to take part in communities, to discuss and to share online. All of these things where there's a conversation created around the practice. Thomas Kuhn used to say that to understand a science is to know how to do or how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. Anyone who's taken mathematics or computer science knows what he means, because the stuff in the problems isn't the stuff that was in the chapter. And the idea here is that learning how to be a professional, a physicist or a doctor or any of these kind of people, is learning not just the stuff, but how people in that community think. To begin even to think like they do, to immerse oneself in that community. To learn how to do the problems at the end of the chapter is to learn to think like a physicist, to think like a computer scientist. And you get that by communicating, conversing with others who are in that discipline. And then the line that cuts through this. Choice, where instead of being told what to do, students now increasingly are deciding what to do. They choose their application, they choose their project, they choose their discipline of study. And then identity, ways for students to project their own identity. An author called Dana Boyd, D-A-N-A-H-B-O-Y-D, has written a number of articles on how environments like MySpace are used by students to express their identity. Now, ways of defining our identity will be important, not just for teaching, but also on technical terms, so that there is an application being developed, or more accurately, a set of protocols called OpenID, which will allow people to determine for themselves, the state for themselves, who they are, rather than have Microsoft or Yahoo or their university control their identity. You know? In the future, you won't be able to tell the students what email address that they will be using. They will come to you and they will say, this is my email address. This is my website. This is where my photos go. You adapt. And then finally, ways of expressing themselves, their creativity, the places where they put things online. This is the model. This is where online learning is going now. It's changing very much from a centralized presentation of learning materials to an environment where students are immersed, they are making choices, they are expressing themselves, and they're being creative. And the personal learning environment is one tool at the center of this that helps make this possible. The Learning Architects Network, in general, is going to include the components that make this work. Things like repositories of open content, open educational resources. Resource aggregation, which is RSS. Rights, ways of expressing digital rights, such as Creative Commons. Personal identity, community, tools where you can produce your own resources, your own content. You will use this architecture, students will use this architecture. Your online environment will become the same as the student's online environment. And in your practice as teachers, instead of telling students what to do and how to do it, you will be doing it. And they will be watching you and watching your model and practicing to try to do the things that you do. So that's where we're headed. Again, to underline, we're at a transition point. We're moving from internet that looks like presentations, and moving toward an internet where everybody makes their own decisions and creates things. I think that this is a move for the better. I think it's going to create an environment where not only the few people who are able to afford college and university tuitions can learn, but an environment where once we get effective, accessible computer access, an environment where everybody will be able to learn, and to learn very much on their own by participating in the community. And it will greatly increase, in my view, the capacity of every person to obtain a quality education. For me, that's the bottom line. For me, that is important. And that's why I'm here today, and that's why it is my pleasure to have been able to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Del CompuGrade que se encuentra ubicado en el siguiente salón. Cambios. ¿Alguien tiene alguna pregunta?
Hay un problema siempre constante en los estudiantes que tienen capacitación o que hacen procesos de capacitación virtual, y es que la mayoría de las veces las personas abandonan la capacitación a la mitad del proceso, independientemente de qué, de cuánto es su costo, de cuál es la responsabilidad que va a cumplir. En nuestro país es muy poca la disciplina para llevar a cabo procesos de capacitación completos, virtuales, exitosos. Usted hablaba algo acerca de la autodisciplina y el autoconocimiento. ¿Cómo podemos, no solamente con la, o sea, no solamente generando procesos para que cada persona haga sus páginas y demás, sino qué otras cosas con más profundidad puede darse a la gente para que realmente siga un proceso con toda conciencia de educación virtual, no que abandone la mitad?
That's an excellent question. The question was, students often abort the process partway through. They, no matter what the motivation, do not go through to completion. And so how do we give them the tools and the motivation to do this, to finish what they started? And I will tell you, first of all, that's not something that has only been seen here. It's also a phenomenon that we've seen in Canada, where people will start the course, an online course or a distance learning course, they'll go through 2 minutes and then they'll stop. I used to teach these courses. It's very depressing if you're saying that. My argument, my suggestion here, is that what will keep the student continuing through is by giving the student the control of the environment. You see, when you talk about students that are stopping partway through, it's always they're stopping partway through a course or a program that has been designed for them. And the only choice they've made is to sign up for the program, and then all the other decisions are made for them. You look at these very same people. When they start to play a computer game, they don't stop. You have to make them stop. They don't eat supper. They don't go to sleep. They play this game and play this game. People stay online for 20 hours playing computer games. And so we do know that there are ways that are used by game designers to engage these students, to keep them continuing on. And they will attempt and master very difficult games. If you've ever looked at a game like MYST, M-Y-S-T, for example, that's a very complex, involved game. Or even some of the sports games. I play hockey. I don't think you have hockey in Colombia, but it's made all of it. And it's a computer game where it's a sports game. It's like field hockey, only on ice, which is actually makes a lot more sense than it sounds. And I play this for hours and hours and hours, and get better and better and better at it. And the point is, it's hard. And Seymour Papert and people like James Paul Chico is hard fun. And the idea here is you draw them in, you engage them by putting them in an environment where they are making choices, they are making decisions, they control the outcome. And indeed, they have even chosen what kind of game it is that they're going to play. I play Civilization because I want to conquer the world. Other people play other games for different reasons. We each choose our own game. And so, this combination, the choice, the mechanisms for drawing people in, this is what keeps people engaged. And we know from the evidence of our own kids, that the mechanism used by games and simulations and other such environments is much more likely to keep and to motivate students than the traditional method where we present them with material, tell them to remember it, and then test them.
Thanks. ¿Alguna otra pregunta? Bien. Siendo así, entonces, a continuación, como les venía diciendo,
Los invitamos a disfrutar del Coffee Break, que se encuentra ubicado en el siguiente salón, Cambridge, donde también se encuentra una muestra comercial de las empresas invitadas. Muchas gracias.